Do both dunes feel like two parts of one whole?
Very much. And I think a lot of that comes down to the way that the imagery rhymes between the two movies. Mm. Early on in movie number one, you get the shot of Arakeen with Leto Atreides kind of looking out over the desert, and there's nothing in the air above the city. It's an illustration of this power vacuum. And then you contrast that against the Emperor arriving on Arrakis near the very end of the second movie, and you get that gigantic, like, silver sphere hanging over Arakeen. Powers come to town, finally.
You're listening to the Bright Wall Dark Room podcast, where we belly up with critics, artists, and our magazine's contributors to speak from the heart about film. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Fran Hoffner.
Thank God.
Can you believe it?
I sure can.
I snuck in at the 11th hour to co-host with Veronica, which it's been a minute.
It has.
Since I've last done that. But first time of the year, let's say it. Maybe the first and only time I'll sneak in as co-host.
Hopefully not the only time, but we always love having you come stage in the podcast world with us.
Oh, yeah. It is a little like that. Yeah. I love to stage.
Yeah.
That's right.
Speaking of our magazine's contributors, we have one as our guest today, and let's just like get right in, especially because I will confess I watched our film, Dune 2, like the day it came out, and that day has had some weeks intervening, and I'm not usually this kind of dusty on the film that we pod about, but I'm excited to wing it. Helping us out will be Sarah Welch Larson. Sarah Welch Larson is a Chicago-based film critic, staff writer at Brightwell Darkroom, and author of Becoming Alien, The Beginning and End of Evil in Science Fiction's Most Idiosyncratic Film Franchise. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you. So happy to be here. This meeting of the Bene Gesserit has now been called to order.
I want to be the hot one, like the Leia Seydoux. Scary, seductive
Lady
one.
Margot Fenring.
Yes.
All the Bene Gesserit are hot if you respect them.
100%.
Somebody to think about.
I mean, Charlotte Rampling, you know, being like the lady president of them or whatever is iconic.
Mm-hmm. That's it. She's the president.
You're going to hear a lot of improvised language from me today around the Duneverse.
Good. I'm here for it.
I think that's totally fine.
People get a little bit too reverential towards the Duneverse anyway, so I'm here to be slightly irreverent towards it.
Well, I look forward to learning the names of all of the characters. And
we'll see what we can do. I'll confess, it's been a couple of weeks since I've last seen it, too. But I saw the movie twice, and I also basically have the book memorized. So,
wow, very good.
I'm very excited to talk about this.
Amazing. Overqualified.
I don't know about that.
I actually want to start with just talking about the images. And I will say I've liked Denis Villeneuve's films for a long time and ended up watching some that I had missed in the, like, weeks since watching Dune Part 2 to kind of prep for the pod, and have jokingly referred to it as screensaver cinema, but it's not really a joke. And I really like that about it. I find it relaxing, but also immersive and kind of involving to watch. But there was this interview that he gave to the Times of London and that got republished in Deadline and all this stuff about how he wants to make quote unquote silent films and thinks dialogue should be relegated to TV and theater. And he says, "I don't remember movies because of a good line. I remember movies because of a strong image. I'm not interested in dialogue at all. Pure image and sound, that is the power of cinema, but is something not obvious when you watch movies today." So I wanted to ask both of you, if you think back to Dune Part 2, are there any particular strong images that feel kind of emblematic of the movie for you?
Right off the bat, honestly, the Sardaukar kind of rising slowly up the side of the cliff right at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think about Dune Part 1 as being a movie that's primarily of images too. And so coming into Dune Part 2, hoping to be surprised in the same way that I was kind of surprised by some of the imagery in the first movie, when the Sardaukar start rising up that cliff, that's when one I knew that I was in good hands because it's such an assured image and it takes its time and it's interested in kind of giving you the alienness of this world without explaining how any of it works. Like, we're not told how they're rising. We just know that they're capable of doing it. And I think that pushes the world a little bit off kilter in a way that I really appreciate, especially because it wasn't something that I was expecting, and it was something that I was hoping to get more and more of. And I feel like the whole movie kind of rewards that if you're looking for that. That image specifically, and then also, I guess we can get into it a little bit more, but like the worms and the way that the worms and the sandstorms kind of mirror each other across both of those movies. And just round spaceships. I love a good round spaceship, and we get a lot of those here too.
I really agree with Sarah that anything in the films that reminds us that we're in space, not just that we're on a different planet, but that we are in space and that gravity works differently, is always really cool to me. I think of both the Sadokar like sort of floating up the cliff, but then also when Josh Brolin's character Gurney is sort of leading one of those like spice extracting trips and just sort of floats down off of one of the spice gathering harvesting machines, I think about that sort of weightlessness a lot and how cool that always looks, not only in Dune, but in space movies in general. I also think a lot about when we're on, I'm forgetting the name of it now. I also saw this opening weekend and then time kept happening to me. When we're on Austin Butler, I think the actor's home planet,
Getty
like
Prime.
Where he came from. And yeah, Getty Prime. And the use of black and white in a way that we've just not really seen black and white used in contemporary film. It's become this kind of visual shorthand to show you something old or from the past. And this is just on a level of like physics showing us a different way in which desaturation can be used in a really exciting and unique way.
That's a fun and interesting way that the movie kind of takes what's in the book and extrapolates it without telling you exactly how or why either. So the scene in the book happens almost exactly the same way that it does in the movie, where you get Fade Rautha fighting kind of a coming of age gladiatorial battle in the arena. And one of his three opponents is not drugged as expected, but in the book, there isn't really much explanation about what the world of Geaty Prime is like, except that they're a world of fascists who love pain. And Fade Rautha in the book carries a pair of knives with him. One is black, the other is white. I believe white symbolizes poison and black means that there's no poison on the blade at all. And of course, there's a little bit of trickery, Fade Rautha being a Harkonnen. So it turns out that both knives are poisoned and that's how he's able to win like a fairly desperate battle. But I love that Villeneuve is like, we're going to take that and we're just going to run with it and we're going to take it to its logical extreme. So it's a planet of fascists. They're thinking in black and white. Their whole world is literally in black and white in a way that I find really striking and just gorgeous and beautiful to look at as well, despite being very, you know, alien and horrifying. And also in terms of the fascism, like also uncomfortably familiar at this point, too. And I love that mix. And I love that Villeneuve just takes this one detail of a black knife and a white knife and just takes it and runs with it completely.
I love that you can tell us that, Sarah. I'm so excited to find out the kind of like fidelity of adaptation, which in general is a question that doesn't always totally interest me. But the way you're explaining how we get from a textual detail into this like elaboration in the mise-en-scene is amazing.
Thank you. Yeah. Reading Dune at 14, finally paying off, I think.
Were there images that stood out to you?
Yes. Yeah. And it was also on this fascist planet. I don't know, wherever we are. But it's something that became more interesting to me, I think. Well, when I was watching it, a thought that I had a lot was, this is the scariest PG-13 movie I think I've ever seen. And I was just kept having moments of being like, I'm going to have nightmares about specific kind of images and evocations of violence, I guess, like that aren't super graphic, but I thought were pretty graphic. And maybe the desaturation is meant to, as it has in other films, kind of like, you know, make the blood less red or whatever. But in the case of this film, I just thought it was totally terrifying and had this kind of music video perfume ad aesthetic that I really respond to. But okay, so in the Max Read Substack annotation of Dune Part 2, which I found incredibly helpful in parsing my experience retroactively, there's a moment where they write, I personally find him, Villeneuve, most compelling in the moments when, somewhere amidst the monumental tastefulness of his visual sensibility, a small bit of Quebecois asserts itself. These deadly sex harlequins at the fucked up S&M Triangle Stadium Only a French Canadian could have imagined them, and their presence is a reminder that the Dune movies are only a few degrees removed from a massive Cirque du Soleil production. Mm-hmm. I wasn't thinking about like S&M or Cirque du Soleil when I was watching them, but I did just find them so terrifying, these kind of black creatures with something like a plague mask slash, it is Harlequin-like though, kind of headpiece. Yeah, I like hated them. I loved them. That was one of the things I took away. And maybe the like broader thing that this is a small illustration of is just the costume work in the movie I thought was totally amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I was thinking S&M the entire time that we're on Giddy Prime, probably because of all of the black leather. And like, I think there are some characters who are wearing masks and look like they've been stitched together from other parts. Mm. I think a lot of that one kind of gets a little bit into the fascism of the Harkonnens, at least in terms of the love of power that they have. And the entire Dune series is about, you know, people's fucked up relationships with power and how they either submit to it or don't. And then what that does to them and to their societies on like a macro scale. And I kind of liked that Villeneuve took that subtext and made it extremely textual in the form of the costumes. Mm. You get a little bit of it elsewhere, but it's really, really blatant whenever you're on Giddy Prime.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the things we're sort of talking around, but feels like worth maybe talking about as like a big idea with these movies, is that even with some distance between having seen the film and thinking back on the film, something that I think Villeneuve has done really well is make what might otherwise feel like this esoteric genre text feel really approachable. And for mm-hmm. all that memory has played with my understanding and my shorthand of referring to celebrities as their characters in the film, like both of these films, I have no previous relationship to Dune as a novel. Mm-hmm. I find them completely comprehensible. I'm never like, where are we? What's going on? And I think that's due to his really meticulous specific production design and visual mm-hmm. language that lets us know where we are and who we're with and how to feel about it.
Totally.
That's kind of gratifying to hear, actually, as someone who loves the novels and who keeps seeing like little shibboleths from the books popping up throughout both of these movies as well. Like there's a ton of little details that the book spends actual pages on, and you don't really get any of that background. You don't get any of that explanation. I kind of like that Villeneuve isn't interested in giving you any of the explanation about like why there are no computers in this world or why you have a bunch mm-hmm. of human computers running around. That's a huge backbone to the plot and why Paul Atreides is the way that he is. Villeneuve just doesn't care about that because he's more interested in the character's relationship to power rather than the thing that makes them have that mm-hmm. relationship in the first place. So that's kind of gratifying to hear that like it doesn't really matter, at least in terms of like understanding and enjoying the story.
I'm curious what you both think is like the best casting decision in this film. Mm. Like whether it's a really, you know, major part or some of the more cameo appearances, like whose performance does it for you?
I have two answers. Well, there's a really obvious one I think we'll talk about no matter what. But I think for me, like I love watching genre films of any and all quality, and a real trademark to those films is usually getting some elder statesman actor or actress to come in and play the president or the captain or some high tier position. And you can really tell who is phoning it in and who is buying into the concept. And I think the use of elder actors, and I think specifically in part one, Charlotte Rampling, mm-hmm. who's also in this one, but also Christopher Walken mm-hmm. in part two. These are great small performances from older actors who are not sort of doing a winking in on it performance. They are really selling the world that they're in. And I think Walken in particular is so subtle in a way that we don't often think of him as being.
He does so much with so little too. I think Rebecca Ferguson as Lady Jessica is probably my favorite casting. Mm. I love her performance in the first movie, and that's what kept me grounded in the first movie when I was a little bit more skeptical about what was going on pre-part two coming out. And I really love the turn that she takes here. The book doesn't give her all that much to do after Paul and Jessica find themselves in the desert with the Fremen. And I like that you still see that level of protectiveness that she feels towards her son and towards her unborn fetus, Aaliyah, which I guess we can probably get into as well, because that's a funky piece of casting too. But I also love kind of the iron will that she brings to the character in both films. And then the turn that she takes towards saying, like, well, once we're on this path, we might as well commit to it. And we're going to commit to it in the most fanatical way possible. Mm. I love watching Rebecca Ferguson do just about anything, especially with the set of her jaw. And she really gets a lot to play with here, even though she doesn't get quite as much screen time as I think I would have liked.
She's so scary. Mm-hmm. I spent a lot of the movie, not having read the novel, kind of like confused about the ambiguity of her intentions or the sort of like reliability of her vision for the future and for her family. And I gather that that's intended and like part of the making more complex and rich her character. And it was kind of nice, actually, as much as I agree with Fran on being more or less coherently situated in time and space and like plot events throughout the film, there were these characterization kind of ambiguities that I thought were admirably complicated, especially for a genre film where I think the expectation is for there to be pretty clear-cut indications like who's terrible and who's virtuous or whatever.
Especially coming from the book where you get everybody's interior monologue explaining the world and how it works and who their loyalties lie with. So there's a betrayal early in the book that is signaled literally from the very beginning. You know who is going to sell out the Duke and you know why he's going to do it and how he's going to do it. And it's kind of more of just this foregone conclusion thing. Mm. With Jessica in the book, you get a lot of her torn loyalties between the Bene Gesserit and their plan to breed themselves a messiah. And then her loyalty towards the Duke, who she is not married to, but may as well be, at least in terms of the world of the story. She's kind of a consort, but she's the person that he trusts the most. Mm. Because she loves him, she bears him a son instead of a daughter like she was supposed to by the Bene Gesserit. And so she kind of has this both like dual loyalty that's not quite completely at odds with each other, but is definitely at tangents with each other and that bump up against each other in really interesting ways. I'm a little bit disappointed that this movie doesn't really get much into her relationship with the now dead Duke, because once he's gone, he's gone. And you kind of get a little bit of that grieving period in the book. Mm-hmm. But I think that loyalty, once Duke Leto is gone, has been transferred entirely to his son, to Paul. I suppose it makes sense, at least for this iteration of the character, to only want his survival and to ensure his survival, because everybody else has disappeared at this point, too.
Sarah, I'm really curious. Could you tell us about like one decision that the movie adaptation makes kind of in departure from the source novel that feels really important or particularly structural for you?
It's the choice to draw out differences in the belief systems of the Fremen. Mm. So the movie kind of differentiates between the southern tribes and the northern tribes. The book doesn't really do that. The book treats the Fremen a little bit more like a cohesive whole. Everybody's religious. Everybody is looking for the Mahdi or the Lisan al-Ghaib, that this messiah that's been prophesied to them. And the messiah has been prophesied by the Bene Gesserit themselves hundreds of years before, kind of planting the seeds of religion that's going to protect them should one of the Bene Gesserit end up stranded on this potentially very hostile world. In the movie, not so much in part one, but definitely in part two, you get the sense that the Fremen are a people who are kind of torn between the true believers and the non-believers, or at least between those who are very skeptical and those who are very credulous about this specific prophecy. So you get Stilgar, who's from the south and who's much more fanatical about his belief that there is a messiah that's going to come and save them all. And then you kind of get this generational divide between him and Chani, you know, Zendaya's character, who knows where this prophecy comes from, doesn't believe it to be true, sees the signs, but is still skeptical about them. And she's worried about where this religious belief and fervor is going to take the Fremen. That's a very big departure, actually, from the book. In the book, Chani believes in Paul from the very beginning. She's actually a religious leader in her own right. And she just kind of falls in step with what Paul wants and with Paul's goals pretty much from the moment that they meet each other. So it's a much more perfunctory relationship in the book. There's a lot less tension between the fact that Paul is still an outsider and he's also claiming kind of this messiahship over the Fremen. the movie, I think, plays with that in a way that I appreciate it a lot more, specifically because it's aware that, you know, colonialism is a thing and that religion can be manipulated towards really bad ends by people who just simply don't care about the people who are being manipulated by it. So I feel like that's an important complication and a good one. And it ends up leading to the movie diverging, not in plot, but in tone, pretty significantly by the very end, in a way that I really liked and in a way that makes me curious to see, well, what is Villeneuve going to do next if he does go on and adapt Dune Messiah? But at the same time, I'm kind of happy with where this leaves off. And if we don't get a third Dune movie, I'm fine with it because the whole story is supposed to feel bad. It's not supposed to be this great triumph, even though it's a military triumph.
I could listen to you talk about Dune forever. I feel like I'm in like the best kind of like grad school lecture. I'm like, that's so true.
Oh my God, thank you.
About the text. I feel like I have read some reviews that sort of suggest that this Dune sequel, sort of going off what Sarah said, is more of Chani's movie than it is Paul's movie. And I was wondering how you two felt about that. If you felt that was accurate to the description of the film.
I'm really thinking about it. I mean, one thing that I found myself doing watching the film, both parts one and two, I guess, was just kind of running a comparison between Timothée and Zendaya and how they're both just these like insect-like performers who, like, so much of their performance is distilled to like gazes, like an intensity of gazes, an intensity of cheekbones. So I think she's given a little bit more to do in part two than he is, despite the sort of journey that he goes on. But her sort of secular skepticism about the whole Messiah prophecy becomes a kind of, at least in my experience, a kind of surrogate for the audience perspective. And I like share that skepticism. I'm like, I don't know if you should drink the blue juice, like what's going to happen? And that kind of anxiety that she is the face of, I think, seems like the sort of intend, at least an intended perspective for me as a viewer to sort of share and inhabit. So in that sense, yeah, I feel like she's the protagonist and there's so much space given, especially in the conclusion of part two, to her, to what I understand only from reading reviews, is also a departure from the novel, her reaction to this union, this political union that happens at the end of the film and the sort of like addition of a lot of emotional gravity to that, to her response to what happens. So yeah, in that sense, I just think she has a lot more juice. Like she just gets to be on a non-linear path and to have a lot more like conflict about what's going on than Paul just seems to be kind of like, is this what I'm supposed to be doing? I guess this is what I'm supposed to be doing, at least in my viewing.
Yeah, that feels accurate to me. Paul's kind of trapped by the forces of history and by the forces that made him. So a little bit of additional book background is that Paul is almost but not quite the end point of the Bene Gesserit plot to breed themselves a messiah. He's supposed to be one generation removed from the Kwisatz Haderach, but because he was born a different gender than what was prescribed for him, and because he has some very specific training, it's speculated that he's just shown up a generation early. And so he spends much of the book being torn between, well, am I supposed to actually fill this role or am I supposed to continue sort of paving the way for this role? Not only is he potentially the end of this specific bloodline, he's been trained as a Bene Gesserit by his mother, which is why he's able to use the power of the voice. And he's also been trained as a human computer. He's a mentat. So he's got both this intuitive quality to himself and then also a very like coldly intellectual quality. And so the point of the Kwisatz Haderach is to be able to look forwards and backwards in time, to kind of be able to remember what happened generations before him and then also be able to see through the consequences of his actions what's going to come next. Some of that is just like hyper reason, basically, like turbo reason, the ability to see everything. But the spice is what kind of kickstarts that ability to make him like actually able to see into the future. But he's kind of trapped in those forces in a way that he himself cannot even control. And the later books get into this as like the ability to see the future actually sort of forces you to have to live it out. So you yourself become like a self-fulfilling prophecy, sort of. And I like that the movie draws the distinction between Paul as this guy who can kind of see what's coming and who doesn't really like it, but is sort of trapped in the gravity well of what everybody else has already decided for him. And Chani is somebody who just rejects that completely and has the free will and the ability to do so in a way that Paul doesn't really feel that he has that option. And Paul could give it all up and walk away from it. But in order to do that, he would have to give up his fight against the Harkonnens, and he would have to give up this like sort of blood vendetta against this family that his family's been fighting for actual centuries. Mm-hmm. The cycle of violence and revenge is something that's really difficult to break. So I think that Paul's still kind of the protagonist, at least in terms of he has this turn of having to move from being very resistant to the call to ultimately giving into it. But he's got absolutely no control over that. His hero's journey, as much as it is literally just one of submission to forces outside of his control, even though he's going to become the literal like emperor of the known universe by the end of that. So Chani feels a little bit less dynamic in a way because she kind of stays the same character path throughout the entire movie. And Paul actually has a bit of a turning point. But Chani also feels much more free of the two. So I find them very interesting counterpoints to each other. I still feel like the story is still primarily Paul's, but maybe that's because the book is kind of ingrained in my DNA at this point.
Wow.
I know. It's so informative.
Sorry. That's great.
I feel like I'm listening to the podcast, not recording it.
Oh my God.
Every month on Bright Wall Dark Room, we belly up with critics, artists, and contributors to speak from the heart about film, which got us thinking, what if we had a space like that every day of the week? A space where artists can go off script on love for their craft.
Introducing Gallery, a new cinema club built by today's most celebrated filmmakers. Helmed by Indian Paintbrush, the folks who brought you the Grand Budapest Hotel and the Asteroid City, Gallery combines personal film collections, thoughtful essays, and live experiences into a single destination. Built by artists as a response and alternative to binge culture, Gallery is not a streaming service. It's all human, no algorithm. A communal cinema experience that celebrates the nuances so often missing in today's industry. And Brightwall Dark Room listeners are invited to receive early access before its official public launch.
Gallery is shaped by many filmmakers that we love here at Brightwall Dark Room, including Mike Mills, Karen Kusama, Ed Lachman, Taylor Russell, Ethan Hawke, and Maggie Gyllenhaal. Members will enjoy access to these artists' hand-picked film libraries, as well as original videos, audio stories, in-depth articles, and exclusive live events. Because, like Brightwall Dark Room, Gallery is a community that believes movies are better experienced together.
To join the club, go to www.join.gallery.com/BWDR. That's GALERIE.com/BWDR.
I don't even know what I was going to ask next. I will say I have like so many dumb questions. Like, why wasn't Austin Butler's character played by Bill Skarsgård?
Oh,
you know, when they dressed up Austin Butler to look like Bill Skarsgård, and then like he's just doing an impression of Stellan, like a good impression.
That's a great question.
I wish I could remember where to source this, but there was some interview snippet at some point where someone Butler worked with, like, I don't think Tom Hanks, but maybe Tom Hanks post Elvis was like, you need to do this. You need to get out of Elvis. So I think it was less about elevating Bill Skarsgård and more about saving Austin Butler from himself. I love that he's in this movie doing that crazy voice. I'm always happy to see someone making a choice in a movie that big in scale because so often it does feel like performances wind up being perfunctory with the role, which is also why I really like Javier Bardem, because my understanding is that Stilgar is, I think, quite tonally different in the book, and I think they made him a little lighter in touch in a way that feels kind of necessary just to balance out like the literal weight of the film.
Yeah, I like the comic relief. I like that he talks about little centipedes and then holds his hands apart like 3 feet apart from each other. Like, that's a very good joke. In the books, the tone that Stilgar has in the movie actually pretty closely matches who he is in Dune Messiah, as like a completely converted, almost religious fanatic. Mm. And that change is very painful for Paul because Paul sees him as more of a mentor figure in the first book. But the change also feels pretty necessary because otherwise it's a lot of grim desert and a lot of darkness. And so it's kind of nice to see Javier Bardem having fun in a movie like this, mm-hmm. kind of in the same way that Jason Momoa was having fun in the first movie. I miss Jason Momoa, by the way. It would be nice to get more of him in the Duneverse.
Same.
Do you think that this movie is fun? I think it is really fun. It's how I would describe it to somebody who had no kind of prior experience with lore or even with Denis Villeneuve's films. I would totally describe it as a fun viewing experience. And I think there's something about the IMAXification of it that enables that. But as you both said, it's also like an incredibly bleak, dread-filled film. How do you reconcile like the viewing experience with the actual tonality of the material?
I think the bleakness of its messaging is kind of this like breath of fresh air for me when I watch it. Mm. Both in the sense that I think compared to a lot of Villeneuve's other films, I think maybe all that I've seen except Arrival, this does feel like one of the more upbeat ones. Coming out of Dune and Dune 2, I don't feel like how I felt coming out of Sicario. But beyond that, I think the blockbusters that we've had prior to this, these big ensemble movies, largely superhero, but not limited to superhero, have this really cynical optimism about the sort of necessity of heroes and messiah figures. And that this is just like the worst thing that's ever happened to Paul ever feels kind of refreshing and funny in a sort of arch way that he has to deal with this. And it doesn't, not to sort of project myself into it, but I'm like, well, this wouldn't happen to me. So I'm sort of, I'm content to not let this get to me too much. But I don't see it. I think it is a lot of fun. Yeah.
Sorry to this guy, but I'm built different.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the fun, I don't know that I would call it fun. I think the thing that I get the most enjoyment out of is seeing everything looking completely different, like seeing the ornithopters, seeing like the spice harvesters that look almost like ticks even before they've hit the ground, kind of getting that sense of visual grandeur. The story is grim enough that I don't necessarily have fun with it, but it is kind of satisfying to watch all of those pieces fall into place in a way. It feels a little bit like a foregone conclusion, but not in a way that feels particularly fun or weightless like a lot of those other lighter ensemble blockbusters. Like, there's definitely consequences to what's happening on the screen here. Mm-hmm. And I find that satisfying. I don't think I find that necessarily enjoyable, though.
Mm-hmm. That is fair. It is almost kind of a relief, I feel, to watch something that does seem to have consequences within itself. Mm-hmm. That the movie is sort of held down by like the weight of not only what's happening on the screen, but tens of thousands of years prior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. I love this idea that this is a kind of antidote to, as you put it, Fran, the like cynical optimism of a lot of similarly scaled films and films that have a kind of like savior component or plotline. The consequences of this holy war that Paul has visions of is like the one thing in the film I wish I had seen. Not that I was like longing for, I don't know, like genocidal imagery or something, but it's just something, the consequences of which I think are a little bit hard to visualize when the film itself feels hesitant to visualize them. But it's also like a lot of stories like this, I love that there's this irreconcilable, like impossible tension between you're gonna want to kill the people who killed your dad, but it also is not gonna help anything ever. And you're just going to do it anyway. And as you put it, Sarah, like he could walk away, but he simply cannot. Mm-hmm. And the sort of irresolvability of that reminds me of like a Michael Mann movie on like a totally different scale.
Mm-hmm. I like that.
Wow. He's been summoned.
Michael Mann.
please log on, Michael. Did you watch it? Maybe he's seen it. Isn't he supposed to put Austin Butler in a movie?
Oh.
Maybe not.
Yeah, maybe.
I want that for me personally.
That'd be crazy.
Yeah.
Do both Dunes feel like two parts of one whole?
Very much.
To you guys, or do they feel like two separate movies? Okay.
They feel very much like two parts of one whole.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a lot of that comes down to the way that the imagery rhymes between the two movies.
Mm.
Early on in movie number one, you get the shot of Eric Keen with Leto Atreides, that's Oscar Isaac's character, kind of looking out over the desert. And there's nothing in the air above mm-hmm. the city. Kind of feels almost like there. It's an illustration of this power vacuum. And he's got to fill it. And if he doesn't fill it, somebody else is going to come in and do it. And then you contrast that against the emperor arriving on Arrakis near the very end of the second movie, and you get that gigantic like silver sphere hanging over Arrakeen, and powers come to town finally, and there's going to be a reckoning. And it's not going to end out very well for the guy who ostensibly holds all of that power, but it's still there. And then there's another rhyming image across both movies that I like very much, and it's when Paul and Jessica are diving into the sandstorm in part one, and he has to just kind of let go of the controls and let them be shaken by the wind. Paul also has to do something very similar when he finally catches the sandworm and rides it for the first time and controls it, where he just kind of, all he can do is hold on to the controls, but he can't actually do very much with them other than just stand on top of this worm. I think the same musical leitmotif is used in both of those scenes as well. I think you get a lot of that, like just rocking, shaking. Like there's a lot of very clear imagery in this movie, but you don't get that in those two scenes specifically, because it's just Paul at the mercy of something that's much more concrete and a lot less abstract than a lot of the other power that's been surrounding him up until that point. I could probably go on, but there's a lot of rhyming imagery between both movies in a way that I find very pleasing, because it's not perfectly symmetrical, but they're definitely in conversation with each other.
Mm. That's amazing.
I might disagree with you.
Oh,
but
bring it on.
This might be sort of where we divide, I think, in that they do feel a little too disparate for my tastes. And I felt as though there was a kind of almost difficult to describe tonal shift between the two films, and not one that felt like inherent to the text because things are getting darker, but rather a sort of lack of balance in context. I wondered if like introducing Fade Rautha in part one would have maybe been a sharper narrative decision, because sort of the introduction of a big bad, even if like the big bad in Dune, kind of my impression is like time, just to give more weight to this general rivalry. And there were times I felt that Dune Part 2 really had to back up and recontextualize something we had seen from the first one. And I felt lucky to have recently rewatched Part 1 before approaching Part 2. But I did feel like there was an assumption in Part 2 that 2.5 years had passed on our current planet that they were acknowledging in the text itself, that felt a little frustrating at times.
Yeah, that makes sense. I kind of wish that we'd gotten more Fade Rautha earlier on too, because it does feel like a little bit of a digression when we go to Giddy Prime. It's just all at once too. Like you don't intercut at all from scene to scene either. And Fade Rautha hangs a little bit more over the entirety of the book. So I'm not entirely sure why they decided to cut him from part one, other than, you know, complexity and the size of the cast to begin with and needing to kind of set the table for the entire story. In terms of Fade Rautha sort of like almost unbalancing it, I think that's kind of fine just because I'm so married to the images, but I can see why that wouldn't necessarily work for you there. I am curious to know how you feel about Timothée Chalamet, because we haven't talked about him very much at all so far, because I wasn't sure that he would be able to carry like the scariness of a character like Paul. And I'm still not entirely convinced that that's the case right up until the very end. There's a bit of a physical transformation, or at least a transformation in the way that he's filmed towards the end, after he's assumed the power and has drunk the water of life and starts yelling at people that he is their messiah, that I don't fully 100% buy. And then the moment when he repeats a line about taking people to paradise, and he says it very softly the second time around, that I find personally scary, but I'm curious to know if that works for either of you.
I really like how he is in part one, and I think his character transformation here is a little trickier. I'm not sure I totally buy it, and it made me think a lot about just Chalamet as a celebrity and his sort of star persona. And I wonder if he always feels better suited to slightly lower status roles that require him to learn or to react. And as Paul becomes an increasingly active character, I sort of never really see the confidence I feel like I would want to see. And perhaps some of that is because Paul is not confident, but it almost feels like Chalamet is really straining to get to that point of inciting fear.
Yeah. I don't like when he tries to be loud. I don't think he's good at it. Maybe it's a craft question where it's like he needs to work with a diaphragm coach or something, but it's just, he's so beautiful and he's so effective in close up. It's great, as Fran, you're just saying, like when he's in a state of receptivity, learning how the Fremen live. I buy that. I buy him kind of being watchful, observant, insightful in that way. But the sort of like more assertive confidence physically, like psychically, I just don't. I think he's like a weird slender vessel for that kind of development. Sorry. Sorry to him.
I think he lacks a really unique physicality. Like, he looks interesting, but he does not really move in a very interesting way.
Right.
He doesn't really carry himself in a particularly interested way. At some points, I just feel myself truly bored watching him walk around on screen because I feel as though he's not really adapting to scenes and situations in a way that is frustrating.
It is funny that the movie like makes fun of that.
That's true, yeah.
By like having this moment of like, you're not doing it right. And then the sort of ensuing choreography I think is very beautiful. But it makes me wonder if Villeneuve is in any way kind of like plugged into exactly the critique that we're sort of sketching out. And if there's any kind of consciousness about that and maybe like a kind of acknowledgement of it that's in the film.
Yeah, I don't know that his physicality necessarily scales up to being a strong man. Did either of you see Bones and All?
Yeah.
Because I thought he was really effective in that, like just kind of on a one-on-one, whenever he's alone in a room with somebody else, you know that he's dangerous, but the stakes feel a lot smaller in that movie than they do here. And so maybe it's, he can't really carry the stakes of an entire civilization on his back necessarily. I feel like he's almost got the potential to be able to do it, but I agree. I don't think he quite manages to pull it off.
And it doesn't help that Oscar Isaac played his father, who I think just has it, like that kind of ethos of believability, whether he's playing kind of a shitty guy. I just rewatched Ex Machina and I was like, oh, it's so funny to see him playing kind of like a bro-y, beefcake-y guy, or whether he's playing someone really sensitive and kind of like the moral compass of an ensemble situation or whatever. But yeah, it's just so believable from him in a way that it isn't for me with Chalamet. But again, I wonder if that's in service to the actual story and his sort of youth and inexperience.
And the fact that he's just kind of caught up in his own situation. Yeah, I'm really curious to see how he grows as a performer and then also how this version of the character grows if we do end up getting a third Dune movie. I don't know that I want him to be like an all-commanding presence because there's a lot of self-doubt in that character, even though he already knows everything. And that almost makes him a little bit scarier because somebody like that, you never really fully know what they're going to do in order to try to shore up their power. On that level, I feel like I can sort of, at least for myself, explain away some of my quibbles with the character, but I don't know that that's necessarily me trying to justify a story that probably doesn't need justification or not. I'm not entirely sure.
Sarah, what is it like the top of your wish list if there is a Dune Part 3?
Oh, man. More creative use of the atomics, the family atomics. Atomic weapons kind of come into Dune Messiah in a way that I find kind of interesting because there are certain conventions against using specific ones on actual people. And I guess that's a Chekhov's atomic weapon or something because that ends up coming into play for these characters. I love Dune Messiah. I love Dune. The first Dune book is not particularly well written, at least on a prose level. Dune Messiah is a definitive like step down from that writing quality, even though it does an interesting job of complicating the plot of the first book. It still feels like an oversimplification. And so I guess my wish list would be take the sketched out story that we get in that sequel and run with it kind of in the same way that Villeneuve has been taking little details and just sort of running with them or alluding to them, but never like actually fully explaining their importance, just kind of leaving them like almost as breadcrumbs for the fans, even though I hate saying, like, you got to do everything for the fans. Like, that is the worst possible motivation for telling a story like this, I think. But I would like to see, you know, more of seeing stuff that we haven't seen before, if that makes sense.
Yeah, listening to you talk about it, I feel like I haven't seen any of it before, including the first two films. So thank you so much for all of your, like, incredibly steeped expertise.
Thank you. Yeah, it's I love these books, and I can't fully justify to myself why I do. And I feel like these movies are a good way of expressing that without actually explaining themselves, which is kind of nice because Villeneuve doesn't really feel the need to explain himself. And now I feel like I don't have to either. And that seems like something that's worth detangling a little bit as well. But that's the kind of thinking that I like to do anyway. So thank you for giving me the outlet, because I've been stewing in these movies for a couple of weeks now, and I almost feel like we've just scratched the surface, so I can keep going for as long as you want me to.
We'll do a pod part two.
Excellent.
Yeah. In 2.5 years.
Yeah.
Yes. With more sandworms.
See you in 2.5 years. A lot more characters.
Yeah. And the tone will be just a little different in a way that's hard to explain. Sarah, my anecdotal understanding from some Dune parentheses the novel fans in my life is that what is cool about Dune a lot of the time is the ideas in Dune, more so than the prose of Dune. Mm-hmm. And that what the Villeneuve movies have done in turn is just make the actual, like, nitty-gritty of going through the plot of this book, like, a much more enjoyable experience. I was wondering if you had a hard sell or not on actually reading the Herbert books.
I feel like everybody should read the first one because it is a much more complex look at a lot of forces that are at work in everybody's lives on, like, a galactic scale. Villeneuve's movies almost feel anemic in comparison in a certain way because they focus so tightly in on Paul. Mm. But the first book deals with the power of government, ecology, how tightly different vendettas can warp people into behaving when they're around each other, kind of family ties stuff going on there, and the sweep and flow of history. That being said, I'm not going to try to convince anybody to read them if that doesn't sound interesting. My best friend absolutely hates Dune, and we had a lot of good conversations about precisely why she hated it. And now she just sends me a lot of Dune memes, which is great for me personally, because I feel like I've won in a way, even though I know that I'll never be able to convince her to like these books.
I'm thrilled that memes are kind of our great equalizer now. You don't really have to like or dislike something. You just have to know what the meme is referencing.
Yeah, just gotta send another video of a cat crawling underneath a blanket that looks like it's going underneath sand or something.
I love it.
I love those.
Mm-hmm.
I love it. I'm here for the abuse of that song.
One other thing that I do want, and this is a little bit facetious, is I want to know how the heck precisely the thumpers work.
Mm.
Because it looks like a really, like, specific piece of, like, almost 3D printed but very polished plastic machinery that's got, like, a hydraulic system in there. And I want to know how they get those to work without them getting clogged up by sand.
Mm.
I work in industrial supplies as a day job, and I think about that sort of thing all the time. And let me tell you, grease and sand don't mix very well. So that thumper is probably the most fantastical piece of instrumentation that they've got going on there. And I just want to pull one apart and see how it ticks.
My friend Bobby made the note that makes its way into the Max Reed piece about, is there some Fremen that has to go around and then pick all those up after they use those? Like, how are they, like, retrieving all of those? Or are they just constantly making new ones and leaving them out in the desert? Makes you wonder about the recycling.
Yeah, I think they're consumables because I think the sandworm, like, literally swallows it.
It's like compost. Okay.
So you're not getting that thing back.
Okay. Yeah. I'm relieved.
So one would hope that they're inexpensive to make, because I wouldn't want to leave that behind for a worm to eat necessarily.
Yeah, if anybody has more information about the production or consumption of the thumpers, you can email us at podcast@brightwalldarkroom.com. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us. This has been, like, such a unique pleasure and, like, truly informative in ways that I had not at all predicted. Where can we find you online?
Thank you so much for having me. It was a delight to speak the good word of the Kwisatz Haderach to you all here. You can find me online at dodgyboffin, that's dodgybofin.com. Links to all of my socials are there. links to what I write. I write a couple of newsletters. And then, of course, I'm also a staff writer here at Brightwell Dark Room. So you can find me at Brightwell Dark Room, where I love to be able to go long on esoteric things such as Dune Part 2 and Thumpers.
Terrific. Fran, also, thank you so much for co-hosting. Do you want to plug anything real quick while we have you?
I'll plug Brightwell Dark Room, the magazine that we all write for.
Beautiful.
Plug Fran Mag.
I'll plug Fran Magazine, the magazine that only I write for. But you guys can come write for me whenever.
I'm going to edit myself to have the Bene Gesserit voice of power there.
Perfect.
Brightwell Dark Room can buy out Fran Magazine, but it will cost $100,000 is the arbitrary amount I've decided.
I think you're underselling it.
Yep, agreed.
That's so nice. Okay, $105,000.
I've been a subscriber since day dot, so it's my favorite inbox treat. To read this month's issue, visit us at brightwelldarkroom.com. You can also find us on Twitter at BWDR and at the BWDR podcast. It would be so nice if you subscribed to the podcast, shared it. It'd be so nice if you rated it. I think our rating is hovering around 4.7. I don't know what's keeping us down, but I would just love if those numbers went up. It would superficially make me feel really good. This episode is sponsored by Gallery, a new kind of film club. Listeners can sign up at join.gallery.com/BWDR. Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.
Eli Sandworm.
Good. Keep that in for sure.
Instead of the trademark buy, do we have a...
Just you doing it, yeah.
Oh, perfect. Good.
Yeah, just cut that in.
Will do.
That's amazing.
Thank you.